Bernard Cornwell is the author of dozens of novels, almost all of them historical fiction. Many revolve around a rifleman named Richard Sharp who fights under Wellington in the Napoleonic Wars. You may remember the television series starring Sean Bean. There are also novels set in the American Civil War that center on Nathaniel Starbuck, the son of a Boston abolitionist who fights in the Army of Northern Virginia. There are novels set in the time of King Arthur. He wrote a bestseller about Henry V and the Battle of Agincourt. We few, we happy few. And recently, he's been writing about Alfred the Great, the Saxon king who drove the Danes out and created England, but only with the considerable assistance of a warlord named Uhtred of Bebbanburg. If you'd like to talk with Bernard Cornwell, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And if you'd like to read the first chapter of his new book, The Burning Land, and the beginning of Uhtred of Bebbanburg's tale, that's at our website at npr.org. Bernard Cornwell's most recent book is, as we mentioned, part of those Saxon tales. He joins us now from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
It's very nice of you to invite me, Neil. Thank you.
And Bebbanburg is a place where, well, is this entirely fictional?
No, it's entirely real. It's called Bamborough Castle these days. It's a beautiful, enormous castle on the Northumbrian coast. It's been there since, obviously not in its present form. It's now a sort of enormous stone Norman keep, but it was once a timber and earth castle. It actually did belong to my family. My father, my real birth father's surname was Uhtred. And that's descended from from Uhtred. And we owned the castle, or the family owned the castle, for 500 years. They lost it in the 11th century.
How careless of them.
It was terribly careless. They fell out with King Canute, which is a very stupid thing to do. And about 2 years ago, I met the sort of present owner of Bamborough Castle, and I said, look, in all fairness, this place belongs to us. I mean, you stole it. And he said, let me show you the heating bills.
I can only imagine, because it is, as you mentioned, on the coast and, storm-tossed by the North Sea.
It's storm-tossed. It's wildly, wildly beautiful. And Bamborough Castle is actually one of the great fortresses. It sits on this rock, and it is just absolutely beautiful. And it's a great place to visit. The whole of that coast of Northumbria is covered with castles and inland, because it's obviously on the border of England and Scotland, and so there was an enormous amount of warfare. And it's great castle country.
Well, we should.
Alnwick Castle is nearby, because where they filmed Harry Potter.
Now, we should mention, however, that Bebbanburg Castle plays a role in the first of the Saxon tales, and Uhtred is then kicked out pretty much and raised by Danes, and spends the next four and a half books yearning to reconquer the castle that's been taken over by his evil uncle.
His evil uncle. I think he's going to spend the next four and a half books doing the same sort of yearning. It puzzled me, because when I first started writing the books, I wondered how on earth did my family hold on to that castle, I mean, to that fortress, because Northumbria was taken over by the Danes, by the Vikings, and yet the family, which was Saxon, held on to that land. It was, at some point, it was called Little England. And I don't know. We don't know. I mean, we know that somebody called Uhtred existed. We don't know anything about him. I mean, almost certainly they held on to the land because they compromised. But I have a slightly more heroic version in the books.
And indeed, well, there's some compromise involved at various points here. But Uhtred fights on behalf of King Alfred, as you point out, the only king in all of British history to be dubbed the Great.
Yeah, I mean, they don't actually have a sort of Nobel committee that sits on this. I mean, it seems to be, it's really capricious who gets called the Great and who doesn't. But he does deserve it. I mean, if it was up to me, I'd add Elizabeth I to the list. But Alfred was, he's great because he preserves what will become England. There comes a point in his reign when he's driven onto the marshes of Somerset by the Danes. And really, if you were a betting man, you have to say that the Saxons are about to be defeated forever. The Danes have taken Northumbria, they've taken the Kingdom of Mercia, they've taken East Anglia, and now it looks as if they're going to take the last kingdom, the Kingdom of Wessex. And once they've done that, we wouldn't be having this conversation in English. We'd be speaking Danish. Yeah. There wouldn't be an England, there'd be a Daneland. But Alfred not only survives, but he lays the foundation for what will become a country called England.
Well, that low point you talk of, that's the story of King Alfred and the cakes.
of the cakes, absolutely, which was made up, at least some people think it was made up, I think in the 12th century by Roger of Wendover. But it's such a great story. I mean, it's like the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. It didn't happen, but it tells us what we want to know about George Washington. And so the story of Alfred and the cakes, even if it was made up by Roger of Wendover, it stuck.
And you have an adaptation of it, not quite Roger of Wendover's story, but...
No, I couldn't resist keep putting it. It's the one thing everybody knows about Alfred the Great, that he burnt the cakes. And so I had to put it in.
Well, this is obviously not your only series, and it was interesting that you paused in media res, if you will, to write a wonderful book about Agincourt.
Well, yeah, Agincourt has always fascinated me. This was the book that was published last year. It's the most famous battle in English history. You won't say British history, because it was the English, not the Welsh or the Scots. And it's still incredible. I mean, newspapers in England after England last year beat the French at rugby, and the headline in a French newspaper was Agincourt. It still has enormous resonance in both France and in England. And it's partly the victory of a small army over a very large army. It's an unlikely victory. And one of the lovely ways to discover what really happened in history is to write a novel about it. So I've always been fascinated by Agincourt, so I went back and wrote the novel.
And does this describe your technique for researching a lot of the periods of history that you write about?
I don't know if it's a technique. I mean, you obviously do an immense amount of research. You have to. But because the further back you go in history, the easier it becomes.
Because there's
not
so
much
is
known about. Yes, you can make up more. I mean, my ambition with the Saxon series is to tell the story of Uhtred all the way through to the Battle of Brunanburg. Now, this takes place 30 years or so after Alfred's death. But once Alfred dies, the records really dry up. I mean, Alfred was a very literate man. He encouraged the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. He wrote himself. We have Bishop Asser's life of him. We have an enormous number of sources for Alfred. Once he dies, it's rather like a light goes out. I mean, suddenly all these sources, well, we still have the Chronicle, but it's not very helpful. And so in some ways, I'm looking forward to the books after Alfred's death, because then I can just let imagination go.
Well, your readers are certainly hoping that Bishop Asser gets his in the end. Anyway, let's get some callers on the line. Our guest is Bernard Cornwell. His most recent book is The Burning Land. It's the latest in the Saxon Tales. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Rick is on the line. Rick calling from San Marcos in Texas.
Hello, thank you very much. It's a live stream to talk to Mr. Cornwell. I have to call him out, however. You mentioned stopping in media res, and I wanted the Starbuck Chronicles to continue. I wonder if you could give us some insight why that stopped.
And again, the Starbuck Chronicles follow Nathaniel Starbuck, the son of the Boston abolitionist minister, through, the first part of the Civil War.
Yeah, we stopped at Antietam. I wanted to hear Gettysburg.
Well, I think you will. I mean, I'll tell you what happened was that, I can't remember when I wrote the last one. I mean, it was a long time ago. Sean Bean came along in the television series. And, that must be 10 years
For Richard
or more
Sharp,
ago.
Yes.
For Richard Sharp. In fact, they're showing two more of that on March 28th and April 4th. There are two new films that I haven't seen, which are being shown on PBS here.
Don't tell me how it comes out.
We win.
Oh,
and,
darn it!
What happened to Starbuck was that once the TV series started, obviously the publishers wanted rather more of Sharp. So I went back and started writing Sharp again. And I hate to say this, but writing Sharp was a little bit like writing Starbuck, and I just didn't feel like doing both at once. So poor Starbuck is in a long furlough, but I do want to get back to him, and I will get back to him, I promise. Fredericksburg is the next one. It's researched. It's ready to go.
Fredericksburg.
Okay, great. Could I put in a good plug for you and say that the best three-volume series on Arthur is yours, Making Lancelot a Cad and pointing out historically that Arthur was never king, works in beautifully, and anybody who hasn't read that needs to.
And curiously, well, so much of it happens in France. But anyway.
Well, yes, we see a lot of the native British who were driven out by the Saxons took the stories of Arthur to Brittany. So there's a whole strand of Arthurian stories that in fact come from Brittany, and of course Chrétien de Troyes. He put Lancelot in. It takes a Frenchman to put adultery into a good English story.
Rick, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Here's an email from Kerry in New Orleans. Is Agincourt a one-off, or do you plan a follow-up?
I would rather like to do a follow-up. Not a follow-up to Agincourt, because I did think about doing a book about the Battle of Verneuil that was called The Second Agincourt that takes place 6 years later. But I think I'm going to resist that impulse. But I am interested in writing about the Battle of Poitiers, which took place earlier, of course. So it wouldn't have the same characters, but it would be much the same setting. So I think, yeah, it's a one-off. It was
Jim,
a very long answer.
Long speech. Can't have the same warriors at Poitiers and Agincourt. Well, unless you really change history. Yeah, Jim is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Cornwell, I've really always admired your books. I was particularly taken with the Archer series and the quality of the longbow is like this early strategic weapon, practically, in the cottage industry of providing arrows for the archers and weaving it in. I believe that's the series that you weave in with the Grail Quest as well.
That's right. Yeah, well, no, the longbow is absolutely extraordinary. It's another of the appeal of the Agincourt book. I mean, if you think that the guys at Agincourt, there were probably 5,000 English archers, they probably took something like a million arrows on that expedition. When the French were actually advancing, when the first French line was advancing, and they probably took about 7-8 minutes to actually cross that muddy field, they were being hit by 1,000 arrows a second.
These were the knights after the crossbowmen.
Yeah, well, the English didn't use the crossbow, and the French never deployed their crossbowmen, which was another reason they lost. I mean, Ben Franklin, who's absolutely no idiot, said that if only the American rebels could be armed with a longbow, they would have won the revolution in 1 year. And the Duke of Wellington actually inquired of London whether it was possible to raise a corps of longbowmen to fight against Napoleon. Well, the truth was it couldn't, because it took about 10 years to make an archer, to become as strong as you needed to be to pull that weapon, and also to learn how to aim it, which was very, very difficult. So it was an extraordinarily difficult weapon to master. And curiously, the only place that seems to have mastered it ever was in the British Isles. The French tried to, and they just never got to it.
Jim, thanks for the call.
I remember as a early watching movies. Years ago, I saw Thomas Castaigne's The Name of the Rose, and there's a famous scene in there where a longbowman takes on a Mongol archer with a
composite bow, yes.
And it's an amazing series of, you know, scenes as he competes, and he just keeps putting the target farther and farther away. It had incredible range. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. We're talking with Bernard Cornwell, historical novelist. The Burning Land is his latest. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Janet's on the line calling from San Francisco.
Hello. I just wanted to say that in 2003, I was in Bamborough Castle, and a friend of mine, an acting teacher, lived there. She was born and raised there and retired there. And she had a friend that lived there. I guess there's condominiums now, and I drank champagne and looked out the window, and it was lovely.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Oh,
and
my God.
You see the Farne Islands, you see the Farne Islands, and you look up the coast to Lindisfarne, Holy Island. It's a magical place, Bamborough, and the castle is wonderful.
I'll never forget it. And we drank champagne and watched the sun go down, and it was. I've never been in a castle before, so this was a great memory.
Janet, was there any graffiti saying Uhtred was here?
I didn't see any.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Janet. Let's see if we can go next to, this is David. David with us from Hickory in North Carolina.
Hi there. I am actually a teacher, a high school teacher, and I teach a British literature course. And I thought this was interesting that this was on because actually this week we're doing Anglo-Saxon history. And I wanted to ask Mr. Cornwell if there were any – I actually teach kind of a lower-level student, and getting them to remain interested in some of the stuff is a little bit tough. So I was wondering if there was any particular research or stories or resources that would be good for this kind of thing.
Oh, well, obviously I'm going to tell you to make them read The Last Kingdom, which is the very first book in the series, and then there's going to be another four for them. I think it's an exciting period, and I think most kids would find it exciting. It's about the Vikings.
Yeah.
It's about these hairy warriors coming ashore and beating the hell out of everybody and how the Saxons fight back. I mean, there's a lot there that is... The curious thing about all this is that the English themselves don't know this history. I mean, for some strange reason, when you if you grow up in England, as I did, history begins at 1066. And everything that happened before that is sort of shrouded in fog and mystery. And so one of the reasons for writing this series is to say to people, look, here's a story that you don't know. And it's a very exciting story. It's the equivalent of England 1776. This is the story of a birth of a nation. And it's a story. It's not just about heroes, because Alfred's daughter, Ethelflaed, becomes a great warrior heroine, and she leads armies against the Danes. And she's been forgotten by history. I mean, even at a time when feminist historians, quite rightly, are trying to pull women out from under the sort of patriarchal shadow, they seem to have forgotten that there is this Ethelflaed, this wonderful woman who led armies against the Danes and beat them. So there's an enormous amount there, and it's all history is story. These are good stories.
We covered her today.
Okay. Well, well done then, David. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Those who've read Bernard Cornwell's stories and will know that the little historical notes at the end are some of the most interesting parts. And there was one at the end of the Saxon Tales, that first one, and it takes away the living image, the one thing everybody knows about the Vikings, the Danes, those hairy warriors who swept ashore, is they wore horned helmets.
That was made up by an opera designer, costume designer, in the 19th century. I mean, they have found horned helmets, but they're almost certainly cultic objects. I mean, I think there's two in the Museum of London, and they're probably not even Danish at all. They're almost certainly Celtic. No, of course the Danes didn't have horns on. They were much too sensible.
Why not?
You wear a horn on your helmet, you can knock the helmet off with a quick blow of the sword. No, it's a wonderful image, and of course it's stuck, and the Minnesota Vikings have it on their helmet. But no, it was made up by a German opera designer.
Well, the Minnesota Vikings knocked their own helmets off last weekend. Anyway,
yes,
that's another story.
Yes.
Bernard Cornwell, thank you so much for being with us today, and good luck with The Burning Land.
Well, thank you very much, Neil.
Burning Land is the latest installment of the Saxon Tales, and Bernard Cornwell joins us today from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. If you'd like to catch some of the Masterpiece Classics dramatization of the adventures of Colonel Richard Sharp, they're airing this spring in March and April. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, a conversation with theoretical physicist Sean Carroll about the mysteries of time and the universe. We'll be back on Monday with a closer look at the Tea Party movement. Have a great weekend. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.